All right, if you guys want to go ahead and turn in your Bibles to Job chapter 9, that's where we'll pick up in our study. I am indeed grateful for the church and the testimonies that were shared and the prayers that were requests that were shared. Faithful ministry that goes on here day in and day out. And I think that study in Job is poignant as we think about the various trials of life that we're all going through to one degree or another. And sometimes, you know, our trials are, in hindsight, comical. It's not on the level of being hospitalized and having to be tested for something going on in your brain, for example. I had one of those experiences last week. I'm not a big advocate of corporate boycotts as kind of making some kind of, you know, statement or whatever. I'm not opposed to them if that's what you want to do, but it's not something that I've ever sort of like signed up for or joined in on. I certainly know that there are many corporations that are, in terms of their sort of corporate ethics or their sort of their place in the culture and what they advocate for is certainly not honoring to the Lord. But yet I also know that that's kind of part of living in a fallen world, and I probably would never be able to be consistent in my boycotting efforts in terms of just needs and consumption. But I am possibly considering starting a worldwide boycott of Starbucks, not because of their certainly ungodly stands in the culture oftentimes, but because of their terrible cups. I had an experience this past week that I'm sure if you've ever gotten a coffee at Starbucks, you possibly have had this experience as well. But I had a piping hot cup of coffee that I'd set in my cup holder, and I get onto the road going in the direction I need to go, and I'm already feeling like I'm going to be a little bit late to a meeting. I reach down to pick up my piping hot cup of coffee, and I pull it out of the cup holder with enough pressure that the thing just collapses, you know, at that seam, those weak seams, and coffee just explodes out. It's one of those moments where you feel like you're on camera, and it seems as though I had a double grande when all I had was a tall, because the amount of coffee that came spewing out, I mean, it was all over my lap. It was everywhere. And I don't know that I said this out loud, but I'm sure some version of the question percolated, pardon the pun, in my mind, why did this happen? Well, there are many, many, many ways to answer that question. You could go all the way back to the manufacturing process of the cup. You could go to Starbucks's procurement decision-making process that probably involves some extreme version of environmentalism that leads to cheap cups. Sorry to be political, but I have a sense that could be in the mix. You could just answer the question based upon physics. I mean, of course, you pick something up and has fluid in it, and you squeeze it, it's going to pop out. In addition, as I continued to go down the road with this hot cup of coffee, not able to do anything about it immediately, I had to slow down, and sure enough, it spilled out the other side as it had already kind of come out all over me. So, I mean, things in motion stay in motion until acted upon by an opposing force, right? It's physics. That's why it happened. That's not the question I was asking. In fact, I would probably have been deeply offended and even more infuriated if you would have answered the question in that way. But it just reminded me as I reflected upon that, that that is fundamentally a question that can plague us when we're going through any kind of inconvenience all the way to some kind of severe and even protracted kind of trial. Kind of difficulty. It is the question, why is this happening to me? And the question is not always a question of pure ignorance. I just gave you answers to the question. It's not like I didn't have answers that I could have, you know, answered myself before I, you know, spilled the next slosh of coffee on my way to try to find a way to clean up. The answers, in some respects, at least some version of answers, were available to me. I didn't have to do an AI search to learn and understand why something like coffee spilling would happen. I didn't have to study, ancient literature. I didn't have to comb the pages of Scripture. I mean, answers were readily available and readily accessible to me. But that did not abate me asking the question and then for some period of time operating in a frame of mind and a disposition of heart that would indicate that I am utterly and completely perplexed by this event and why something like this could possibly happen to me. And this is where we find Job. In fact, this is where we find Job in a pronounced way in his response to Bildad's counsel that we looked at last time, as we see it unfolding in chapter 9. Just to kind of remind us a little bit of kind of where we are in the flow of this narrative, as you, I'm sure many of you, if not all of you, are well familiar with the general story of Job. All of you that have been in the class are well familiar with it. But you know that Job is undergoing a severe season of trial. He has suffered the loss of all his possessions. He has suffered the loss of his family. He has suffered the loss of his influence and his reputation. He is now suffering physical ailments of a type that's probably hard to imagine with sores, a kind of sore that would just cover his body from head to toe, painful sores, infectious kinds of sores. So he had troubles from every conceivable angle, every point of sort of determined health. My business and my finances are healthy and robust. My family is thriving and things are going well, and I'm in good health, and thank the Lord for my good health. All those things, every sort of major category of stable, healthy, productive, optimistic life was completely decimated. And as we know, that happened as a result of a challenge that was offered up in this divine council where the Lord himself brought Job's name to the attention of Satan, who had sort of interloped into that divine council. And there was a challenge that was issued forth, and Satan was given permission to bring about these trials that I just sort of briefly described. And that led to the visit of these three friends that came to see Job in his grief, that then turned into a bit of an ongoing counseling session, if you want to call it that. These three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, engage in what are these cycles of counsel. And this long section in the book of Job that begins in chapter 4 and continues all the way through chapter 31, it's called the speeches or the dialogue section. And you have this series of dialogues where one of the friends will offer up a word of counsel and then Job will respond. And then the next friend will offer up some word of counsel and the friend will respond, and it goes on like that. And there are three cycles of these dialogues in which, two cycles in which all three friends offer their counsel and then Job responds. And then in the final cycle, Zophar bails out. Zophar is the hothead of the group, and he, by some reasonable speculation, may have just been too exacerbated with Job and just said, I'm not going to engage in this anymore. So we don't find his final word of counsel coming forth in the same pattern as it did in the prior two. And looking at this, what we are kind of the approach that we're taking with this study and this sort of survey of this large section is we're getting a sense not just of the profile of these friends, but also the nature of the counsel, the things that are sort of informing their approach to counseling someone who is in a protracted and severe season of grief and trial. And we're also noting ways in which Job is both responding to them, but also responding to the trial itself. And being provoked by their counsel, being discouraged by their counsel, and then also lamenting the fact that he is persisting in this season of grief in which he has no concept of why it's happening. None whatsoever. And as we've discussed, the real backdrop of all of this, and we've sort of framed up this large discussion as really what we're observing is a bit of a theological crisis. You could even argue that my coffee episode presented a little bit of a theological crisis in a sort of an absurd kind of way. But if you were to sit down with me, if, for example, we would have had coffee in the coffee shop as opposed to me getting in my car, and we were to start to have a discussion, for example, about the providence of God, oh, I could wax on eloquently about the providence of God. But allow a bit of coffee to spill on me in the car, I have no idea what the providence of God is all about. None whatsoever. So you understand what I'm saying. We are constantly sort of walking in, living in, working through some degree or some measure of theological crisis. And oftentimes, the degree of that crisis becomes more pronounced, more significant when we are in the throes of some trial. And you can only imagine when you consider the degree and extent and type of trials that Job was enduring, that this was putting that on big display. It was bringing all of that to the surface. But also behind all of that was this erroneous understanding that was common in that period of time in the ancient Near East, but it was also common amongst these men, Job himself included. And it's this skewed or misunderstood view of the justice of God. We sort of categorize that under this umbrella of retribution theology, or viewing the justice of God as purely and exclusively retributive, meaning that God metes out his justice upon men in direct correlation and proportion to their actions. And so, therefore, the good and upright person receives the justice of God in the form of blessing, and the wicked, sinful person receives retribution, retributive justice in the form of suffering and trial and judgment and punishment. And it happens immediately in direct correlation with and proportionately to the actions of the person. And this is sort of the theological framework of God's justice that is firmly ensconced in the hearts and minds of Job, but also his three friends. And so we see this sort of playing out, this insistence upon this kind of understanding of the justice of God, but then also that perspective being utterly and completely challenged and turned on its head because of Job's actual experience. Like, reality is not lining up with their theological conclusions. And we've seen how when that is in the background or even in the foreground of counsel that we bring to bear, especially with someone who's suffering, this is what you find happening with these three men. Job, deal with your sin, brother. You're going through this because you're defiantly resistant to owning up to your sin, acknowledging it, repenting of it, so that then you can be the beneficiary of God's manifold blessings that he will bring to you once again. And so their counsel is often informed by that kind of theological presupposition, and it's hardly ever seasoned with any kind of compassion, patience, any kind of encouragement that would enable him to endure and to just kind of take the next step in front of him, put one foot in front of the other, and find a sense of accomplishment and a sense of satisfaction in the fact that you just made it through another day and that's enough for now. Those kinds of points of counsel and encouragement are not being brought to bear for him. It's quite the opposite. It's this matter of just get yourself right. Get yourself before God in a just fashion, and then you will receive just reward. Until then, you will be the subject of his condemnation and punishment. Now, we've seen the profiles of these men sort of emerge in this first pass of their counsel, and we noted how Eliphaz, as the older of the three friends, was seasoned with a little bit of wisdom, a little bit of compassion, even though he did resort to some condescension and even presumption about what God would do for Job if he would merely own up to his sin and repent. So his counsel initially was the most helpful start, if you will, even if it wasn't thoroughly productive. And of course, we also saw how Job responded to that and how the nature of Eliphaz's final counsel being condescending to Job and really not interpreting his circumstances accurately, it really multiplied Job's grief. It didn't help him endure the trial more successfully or more effectively or more faithfully. It certainly didn't encourage him in endurance in the trial. It only multiplied his grief. It brought about more discomfort for Job. It increased his despair. It actually debilitated him in his endurance. And it ultimately led to a fracture in their fellowship and a breakdown of the trust between them. So you have all the elements here of a counseling session going very, very poorly. The end game, the end objective of counsel is the exact opposite of what happens. Their grief is not relieved. Job's comfort was not brought to bear. His despair was not dealt with effectively. His endurance was not encouraged. The fellowship that they shared between them was not enhanced. And ultimately, Job felt like he couldn't really trust their counsel at all. We also noticed how Job's outlook became very, very bleak as a result of this counsel, and even his faith was obscured. He couldn't hold on any longer to that which he could not see, which is fundamentally the essence of faith. We have faith in that which we can't see with our own eyes, but that we know with great assurance. And so he was losing his ability to hold on with faith in the God who had shown himself strong and faithful for year upon year upon year. That experience with God, that relationship and fellowship with God, was being completely obscured because of his own dimmed theology. And then we turned to Bildad, and we began to see that Bildad, not quite as sensitive and compassionate with Job. He was more defensive and direct in his approach. He was more blunt right from the jump. We looked at that in chapter 8. Even brutally blunt with Job. His sympathy that he tried to communicate to Job was incredibly simplistic in nature. It was as though he was oversimplifying the nature of Job's trial and therefore oversimplifying what the path toward relief from the trial would require. He was overly deferential to the wisdom of the ages of past fathers. He was basically bringing to bear something that didn't really apply to this situation. And he was doing all of this with very artful language. So imagine a counseling situation where you're someone who's in a state of tremendous grief because you've suffered a tremendous loss or a series of losses. And the weight of your grief and the depth of your pain and your anguish is pronounced. It's sort of on the surface. And you've got someone who is direct with you because they're defensive. Like, they're offended by the fact that you're not getting it. And they see you as sort of an affront to God himself, that somehow by virtue of you not having a theologically sound mind at the moment in the midst of your grief, that is an affront to God, and somehow that unsoundness of mind can sort of maybe tilt God off of his just throne for a moment. And so I'm the one that's going to defend God's justice. And so therefore it's a call for me to be direct, for me to be blunt, like brutally blunt with you. That's my counsel. You've got to get your head screwed on right. And my sympathy toward you, if you want to call it that, is just overly simplistic. It's not even taking into account the complexities of the trial that you're in. All these things, and by the way, I do all of this in my counsel in the most artful, eloquent words that you could possibly imagine. That is devastating in terms of effective counsel. And so the challenge that is afoot here just continues. And now we arrive at Job's response to this kind of counsel from Bildad in chapter 9. And what we see once again is the structure here of Job's response to Bildad It really takes up two chapters, chapters 9 and 10, and it's similar to what we saw in his response to Eliphaz in chapter 6 and 7, in which he begins in the first chapter of his response with a response directly to the counselor. So in this case, it's sort of a response to Bildad, and really by extension to the other men that are there with him. And then the next chapter, excuse me, is more of a lament. It's more of a lament and an appeal to God. So he responds directly to his counselor in the first section, and then he is offering up lament that is more directed at God in the second part of that response. And what we continue to see throughout both of these sections in chapters 9 and 10 is this measure of a certain degree or a certain number of sound theological utterances, indications that Job is operating from a place of sound theology, of a clear understanding of the nature and character of God in some ways. But it's also mixed with these declarations that are rooted in Job's own understanding and belief in this retributive form of justice, where God blesses the upright and punishes the wicked, again, in direct proportion to their actions, to their deeds. And of course, all of this in Job's response in 9 and 10 is peppered with extreme emotional anguish, and the kind of anguish and emotion that yields up incoherence, it yields up contradiction, it even yields up error, theological error. This is what can sometimes be challenging or confusing when we study this book, is that we're kind of reaching for, okay, he's on to it, like he's making sense, like he's got it clear, and then he just goes off the rails. And he begins to sort of just cry out in anguish and despair. And he begins to say things that are directly contradictory to what we thought Job understood earlier in the chapter about God and about how that might have implications for what he's going through or how he should respond to it. And there's this sort of cognitive dissonance as we kind of read Job's own words and his response to these counselors. And we certainly see that here in this response to Bildad. It's this mixture. Now think about this when you think about counsel and discipleship itself. You and I just gave you, again, a simple illustration of what goes on when we go through some kind of trial. We can speak in ways that are totally foreign to what our stated confession is. We can react to the circumstances, the visceral trials of life, in ways verbally that totally contradict what we claim we believe. We can at one moment be rock solid and at the next moment be utterly and completely incoherent and even borderline, seemingly, alarmingly blasphemous, as though we don't know God at all. And if you're honest, I think, with yourself, and if you think carefully about your own experiences with counseling others, you would say, yeah, that happens. That does happen. And so this whole dialogue section kind of gives us this picture, this window into these kinds of counseling interactions, and they serve as, in some ways, a bit of a caution or a warning to us to make sure we kind of see what's going on and we engage properly in ways that are most effective, most fruitful, most honoring to the Lord, and most beneficial to the one who we're trying to help. And we see Job expressing things that just don't seem to line up with what we thought he understood, and it just makes the process of working through this text all the more difficult. And then you add to it the poetic nature of the language itself. This is a big chunk of Hebrew poetry, basically. And so there's a lot of emotional flourishes, and there's a lot of imagery and metaphor and that kind of thing that is intended to be emotive in nature. It's not written completely in a way that would sort of didactically go at your mind and your thinking in very logical ways so that you can just kind of piece things together and go, okay, this makes sense with that, and then there's the final conclusion. So you got this mixture of emotion and sound doctrine and confusion and real pain and suffering all written in poetic language. And here we are trying to figure out what to do with it. Now, to reset our context for Job's response to Bildad, let's just read briefly in chapters 9 and 10, just a few little sections that kind of give us a sense of what Bildad has said to Job. If you look, first of all, in chapter 8, verses 2 to 7, Bildad says to Job, "How long will you say these things, and the words of your mouth be a great wind?" He calls him a windbag. Not a nice thing to say. And then he asks these questions. Does God pervert justice? Or does the Almighty pervert the right? If your children have sinned against him, he has delivered them into the hand of their transgression. A very, very cold-hearted thing to say. He suffered the loss of his children. Verse 5, "If you will seek God and plead with the Almighty for mercy, if you are pure and upright, surely then he will rouse himself for you and restore your rightful habitation. And though your beginning was small, your latter days will be very great." There is retribution theology in a nutshell. He's just kind of laid out the formula. Do you see that? You notice the bluntness, calls him a windbag, saying the words that you're saying are just wind. They just float through the air and they're completely empty. And there's a bunch of them, and they're all empty. And then he challenges him in this defensive way about maybe a slight accusation that Job's response is a perversion of God's justice. It's a perversion of God's rightness. And then he pierces him with this statement about the judgment of his children. And then he lays out the formula. Here's all you got to do. If you'll just do this, then everything will be fixed. You get down to the end of the chapter, in chapter 8, verse 20 to 22. He kind of makes this bold declaration. He says, "Behold, God will not reject a blameless man nor take the hand of evildoers. He will yet fill your mouth with laughter and your lips with shouting. Those who hate you will be clothed with shame, and the tent of the wicked will be no more." This is the nature of Bildad's counsel to Job. And again, it's loaded with this retribution theology principle concerning the justice of God. So now let's pick up in chapter 9. This is Job's response, and it's a very quick read. I'm going to read the whole chapter, and then we're going to kind of do a quick survey of its contents. Verse 1, "Then Job answered and said, 'Truly I know that it is so. But how can a man be in the right before God? If one wished to contend with him, one could not answer him once in 1,000 times. He is wise in heart and mighty in strength. Who has hardened himself against him and succeeded? He who removes mountains and they know it not, when he overturns them in his anger, who shakes the earth out of its place and its pillars tremble, who commands the sun and it does not rise, who seals up the stars, who alone stretched out the heavens and trampled the waves of the sea, who made the Bear and Orion and Pleiades and the chambers of the south." This is a reference to the constellations and the heavenly bodies. "Who does great things beyond searching out and marvelous things beyond number? Behold, he passes by me and I see him not. He moves on, but I do not perceive him. Behold, he snatches away. Who can turn him back? Who will say to him, 'What are you doing?' God will not turn back his anger beneath him. Bowed the helpers of Rahab." This is a reference to an ancient sort of chaos monster, if you will. This is just a reference to God seizing control and bringing order out of chaos. "How then can I answer him, choosing my words with him?" Verse 15, "Though I am in the right, I cannot answer him. I must appeal for mercy to my accuser. If I summoned him and he answered me, I would not believe that he was listening to my voice. For he crushes me with a tempest and multiplies my wounds without cause. He will not let me get my breath, but fills me with bitterness. If it is a contest of strength, behold, he is mighty. If it is a matter of justice, who can summon him? Though I am in the right, my own mouth would condemn me. Though I am blameless, he would prove me perverse. I am blameless. I regard not myself. I loathe my life. It is all one. Therefore, I say, he destroys both the blameless and the wicked. When disaster brings sudden death, he mocks at the calamity of the innocent. The earth is given into the hand of the wicked. He covers the faces of its judges. If it is not he, who is it then? My days are swifter than a runner. They flee away. They see no good. They go by like skiffs of reed, like an eagle swooping on the prey. If I say I will forget my complaint, I will put off my sad face and be of good cheer, I become afraid of all my suffering. For I know you will not hold me innocent. I shall be condemned. Why then do I labor in vain? If I wash myself with snow and cleanse my hands with lye, yet you will plunge me into a pit, and my own clothes will abhor me. For he is not a man as I am, that I might answer him, that we should come to trial together. There is no arbiter between us. Who might lay his hand on us both? Let him take his rod away from me, and let not dread of him terrify me. Then I would speak without fear of him, for I am not so in myself. This is quite an initial response by Job. And as I said, you probably picked up on this mixture of sound theology, of anguish, of incoherence, of contradiction. It even begins here at the very top of this section with what I just call a begrudging and unsettled acknowledgement on the part of Job. In verse 2, he says, "Truly I know that it is so, but how can a man be in the right before God?" In a sense, he is acknowledging that much of what Bildad said to him, he kind of agrees with. But it's definitely unsettled. It's an unsettled kind of acknowledgement that Bildad is certainly speaking things that comport with his own theological convictions. This is basically Job's perplexed affirmation of what Bildad said. It's his affirmation of retribution theology that Bildad just articulated. Bildad asks him in chapter 8, verse 3, "Does God pervert justice? Or does the Almighty pervert the right?" Job would adamantly respond, "Of course he doesn't. I agree. That would never happen." Bildad makes this grand pronouncement in chapter 8, verse 20. "Behold, God will not reject a blameless man, nor take the hand of evildoers." And Job's long-standing theological assumption would compel him to respond, "Hear, hear. Amen. And amen. Truly," he says, "I know it is so." Yes, this is how we are to understand the justice of God. But wait. Hang on a second. He would have to be saying, "I am a blameless man. And by every observable account, God has seemingly rejected me. So I agree theologically, but I can't possibly agree by my experience." He said in this section how he declared his own blamelessness multiple times. Did you pick up on that toward the end of the chapter? So here he is sort of reluctantly agreeing, kind of affirming the broader theological principle of God's retributive justice, his way of meting out justice, of blessing the upright and bringing punishment and judgment to the wicked in proportion and in direct correlation to those deeds. And yet he's looking at himself and he's saying, "Wait a second, this is not adding up. Yes, but no. The math, in other words, is no longer adding up." And you're starting to see the heat of this crisis, this theological crisis, kind of amp up in Job's heart and mind. Think of this like a series of simple formulas that Job's just sort of kind of working through in his own head. Consistent blamelessness times retributive justice equals multiplied blessings. It's that simple. Persistent sinfulness times retributive justice equals multiplied punishments. That's the formula. But Job's experience might seem something like this. My consistent blamelessness times God's retributive justice equals multiplied blessings minus multiplied blessings plus multiplied punishments. The formula just got a little more complicated and unwieldy, didn't it? And this is what he's experiencing. Something for Job is way off. The calculus is not working out at all. So he acknowledges reluctantly and also doubtfully, even in his own heart and in his own mind. He says, "Truly, I know that it is so. I know the formula. But how can a man be in the right before God?" That's coming out of his own experience. How am I supposed to reconcile the fact that I'm blameless, and yet my experience would argue that I am utterly wicked and deserving of such grief? Well, this takes you to this next section, the larger portion of chapter 9, that I think is so critically important for us to sort of think about for a few minutes, particularly as it relates to the ways in which we endure trials of our own, but also the ways in which we seek to help and counsel others who are going through serious and protracted trials and seasons of suffering. What you see unfolding after this sort of reluctant acknowledgement that's sort of half-hearted and a little bit confused and perplexed with a question on the other side of it, is you see Job's sound theology being undermined by unsound anthropology. Okay? Sound theology that is undermined by unsound anthropology. And I would argue that this conflict is often at the root of very, very protracted periods of trial and suffering that are not being walked through with consistent endurance and faithfulness. It's the spilled coffee scenario of, why is this happening to me? What, I ask you rhetorically, is the assumption behind such a question? It's nothing other than, I don't deserve this. I don't deserve this. This is a legitimate question for me to ask. I shouldn't be having to go through this. I use the coffee illustration as an absurd illustration to make the point that even that kind of theological assumption is behind something as almost trivial, like a spill of that sort. It's not just a question of perplexity, of I'm confused, or even just raw emotion. I can confess to you, as I think back on that experience, what was sinfully in my heart and my mind is this conclusion that I don't deserve this. Not today. I've got a meeting to get to. So our sound theology can be radically undermined by very unsound anthropology. And this is what we see. In verse 3, we see Job rightfully declaring that no one can contend with God. God is in the heavens, he does what he pleases. No one can contend with him. In verse 4, we see him making the statement that he is infinitely wise and powerful, and anyone who stands against him will fail. True. Verses 5 to 10, we see him making a declaration that his sovereign power is demonstrated in his creation and in his command over all things in the natural world and in the heavens above. That God is not only sovereign creator, but he is sovereign sustainer and manager and overseer and upholder of everything that we see in the physical universe. This is the sovereign God. And his power is on display in everything that I observe around me. In verses 11 and 12, his ways are often imperceptible to us, yet they are not subject to man's assessment or judgment. Another way to say that is, just because we don't understand what God is up to or doing does not give us the right to call his judgment into question. We may do it out of emotion, we may do it out of weakness, but we're never, never justified in doing it. I don't care what the psychotherapist might tell the broader world. In fact, you see this here. He kind of references, there's an echo here of Isaiah 45:9, which is also sort of restated in Romans chapter 9, which says, "Woe to him who strives with him," speaking of God, "woe to him who strives with him who formed him. A pot among earthen pots. Does the clay say to him who forms it, 'What are you making?'" This is what he's referring to. He's rightfully declaring that it is not the prerogative of the creation to call out in judgmental questioning the one who made him, the creator, even when we don't understand what's going on. So all of these are very clear and even potentially helpful reminders, declarations, statements about who God is. His power, His authority, His wisdom, His mystery in His operations, and His divine right to do as He pleases in the world that He made and among the people that He created in His own image. He has the undeniable divine prerogative there. And so Job is locked in this portion on very sound theology. But then he moves into what you could broadly say is an unsound type of anthropology. Now, there's a little bit of nuance here, and I'll mention it in a moment. But notice in chapter 9, and really it's 15 through 21, you just see this percolating, what I already alluded to before. "Because I am blameless, I don't deserve this." This is what he's saying in that whole diatribe in verses 15 to 21. He's saying, "I'm blameless." He declares himself, I'm blameless. I'm in the right. And do you notice that he comes right up to the edge of saying that therefore God's not in the right? But he doesn't say that. He's pushed to that point. He understands the logic of his own dilemma. In other words, he has not grasped the reality that though he is not blameless in the way that retribution theology, which is erroneous, would dictate he must be blameless or he must be sinful if he was receiving all this punishment. He knows that that's not the case. But he can't consider himself to be utterly blameless. He can't consider himself to be utterly without sin, or somehow that he is not deserving of any form of suffering. If God is who he just said that he is, does that not then extend to the conclusion that it is God's prerogative to operate in the affairs of men with his creation according to his purposes that are often imperceptible, unknowable? Is it not his divine right to do that? And for you to contend with that, you'd be a fool. No one can stand up against him. Job, those are your own words. Where's the disconnect? This is what cripples believers frequently, myself included. When I lose my hold on not my theology, my clarity about the power and authority and wisdom, even the goodness and faithfulness from generation to generation of Almighty God. I can declare that from the mountaintops without hesitation over and over again. Most of the time, I would have to say that my theology on that level is sound generally, but my anthropology is completely messed up. Because I'm thinking to myself, why are these things happening to me? Why am I going through this? In other words, I'm adopting a disposition of heart and mind that somehow the experience of my life should be characterized in ways that I have determined are best for me. And I, in just in that mere description of the thinking that can be in play, I completely undermine my grand sweeping declarations about God's prerogatives, about God's authority, about God's wisdom, about God's control and management of everything in the universe, His sovereign reign. I completely undermine it in a moment, just like that. Again, the compassionate counselor is not to be hammering away at that kind of truth without any patience with someone who's struggling, because as we see also from Job, there are cries out that come out of a real visceral anguish that he's experiencing. There's pain and there's suffering and there's a wrestling with hopelessness that's underway. But nevertheless, we have to be reminding ourselves not just of who we know God to be, but who we also know we are before Him. In general, the plight of mankind, which all of us are included in, allows for such suffering. It allows for it. And in fact, to take it a step further, for the believer, there is an exposure in our hearts and minds that would indicate that we have determined that this life and the experiences and values and measures of good things, blessings, benefits, health, and all these things, the earthly temporal measures are more important than eternal hope. More important than resurrected life. More important than the eternal kingdom. More important than what our ultimate, what we've been saved to. Jesus, in teaching his disciples shortly before going to the cross in Matthew chapter 16, speaks of the person who gains the whole world yet forfeits his soul. And we can be characterized by that when we start to have a grip on the things of this life, the experiences of this life, the things that we suddenly become feeling like we're entitled to in this life. And we are no different than the person who feels like that they're gaining the whole world, but ultimately they're forfeiting their soul. And Jesus himself said in that passage, he said, you got to lose your life to gain it. You got to give up your life. You got to take up your cross and follow me to gain true life. At the National Legionnaire Conference in 2014, one of the most viral moments in any Q&A session I've ever watched occurred. You may have seen it. You may have heard about it. It's so much better to watch, but I'm just going to read a brief portion of the transcript. R.C. Sproul was on the platform. And the moderator asked this question on behalf of someone who had submitted it from the audience. Here's the question. If God is slow to anger and patient, excuse me, he says, since God is slow to anger and patient, then why, when man first sinned, was his wrath and punishment so severe and long-lasting? R.C. Sproul said abruptly, loudly, time out! In a room filled with conference attendees, he, with a righteous indignation, yells, time out! Buckle up for the rebuke. Here it comes. He goes on. Didn't we just have that question a second ago? There was a similar question that was asked, calling God's justice into question. And then he said that God's punishment for Adam was so severe. He says, this creature from the dirt defied the everlasting holy God after God had said, the day that you shall eat of the fruit, you shall surely die. And instead of dying that day, he lived another day. and was clothed in his nakedness by pure grace, and had the consequences of a curse supplied for quite some time, but the worst curse would come upon the one who seduced him, whose head would be crushed by the seed of the woman. And the punishment was too severe. And then he screams out, "What's wrong with you people?" Now, that's at a Q&A session at a conference. Thousands of people out there, and he's declaring, "What is wrong with you people?" And when you see the look on his face, he couldn't be more serious. He goes on to say, "I'm serious." Because there was a little bit of laughter, a little bit of awkward, uncomfortable laughter that happens in the audience. "I'm serious. I mean this. What's wrong? This is what's wrong with the Christian church today. We don't know who God is, and we don't know who we are. The question is, why wasn't it infinitely more severe?" That's the question. We have been redeemed to suffer in this life. That's not a bleak statement, especially if you think like the Apostle Paul, because he says, "I rejoice that I share in the sufferings of Christ." It's not bleak if we echo what James taught in that, "I count it all joy when I face trials of many kinds, knowing that the testing of my faith produces endurance. And endurance will finish the work of making me mature and complete so that I lack nothing. I rejoice in that." We confirm what Jesus said, that in losing our lives, we gain it. That we have been redeemed with eternal hope. And like Paul, "For me to remain is better for you, but I'd really rather go home and be with the Lord." That's the tension and tug of my heart in this life. And this is what Job was having to grapple with, and this is what we will find becomes the answer for him when he is met by the Lord when we get further along in the study. Let's pray.